"You tell me," said Lily angrily as we drove into Westchester County, headed for White Plains, "how a car parked next to Madison Square Garden just disappears." "Car thieves," I replied, "are quick as whippets. They've been known to steal cars during the minute or two it takes someone to go from the curb to the box office 10 feet away." "It wouldn't surprise me if Brad gave the Avondale to her and really never reported it stolen. My guess is the car was stolen, but not in the place he said it was." Lily shot me a dangerous look. "You know something, don't you?"
"Just what I hear."
"Which is?"
"Some husbands would rather not say where the car was actually parked."
"I see. In fact, I see very clearly. Thank you," she said curtly. For a few minutes, the car ran on silence. I looked out the window at the August woods, while Lily stared straight ahead, drawing a bead, I surmised, not on the road, but on Brad.
"The Avondale was one of the few things about him I liked. Now that's gone."
White Plains, the legal center for the Hudson River area, had been in the spotlight numerous times for sensational trials. At the old courthouse on Railroad Avenue, renamed as Main Street, a number of great jurists and advocates had spoken, for example, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. Now, Bill Fallon was to spin his magic at the new courthouse on the same site. We parked on the street. Lily pointed out Fallon's Cadillac. He and Rodman had preceded us by a day because Bill wanted to have a walk around town to sample local opinion on the issue of bootlegging. They'd been here before, when jury selection began, but Fallon had wisely sought a delay. At last, I was to meet the great man, the one who defended the underworld, the one who had arranged to have the charge against me thrown out of court, the one who had never, in fact, lost a case. From Carolyn and A.R., and also from Lily, I'd heard how his logic mowed down lawyers and judges and even Jesuits. Famed for producing hung juries, Fallon could read a 300-page brief in less than 2 hours and virtually recite the entire document word for word. Carolyn told me to listen to him closely. "He tells everyone that he plays on his voice as a master plays on the strings of his harp, and he does." A.R. admired his skills but deplored his excesses. "Fallon," he grumbled before I left for the trial, "drinks and smokes too damn much, wears cheap shirts, never polishes his shoes, can't save a nickel, and has a glass backside. He's afraid it will bust if he ever sits down." When I ironically asked anything else, A.R. seriously added, "Yeah, he's also a sucker for a pretty face. He'll never charge a dame who's a looker." The courthouse, constructed of artificial stone and colored light pink, had one heck of an imposing entrance. 12 fluted ionic columns, 4 stories high. The inside was even grander. A large central hall, much like a rotunda, rose the full height of the building to a glass skylight. Looking up, you could see all the floors and staircases spiraling right to the top. The walls and columns, all faced with travertine marble, gave the place a classical look. We found Rodman and Fallon in a waiting room just off the main hall. As soon as Hank spotted Lily, he ran and embraced her with such force, you'd have thought someone was trying to take her away. Fallon, dressed in a blue serge suit with a burgundy necktie and scuffed oxfords, smelled of liquor. From his solemn look, I figured he expected to lose. Only his intense blue eyes gave any indication of the fire inside. A handsome, well-built man with a finely chiseled face, he was about A.R.'s height, a few inches under 6 feet. He had shapely hands, but bit his nails to the quick. His most prominent feature, as I'd been told, was his hair. Apricot, I would call it, or reddish blonde. Carolyn said that it shone because he used a henna rinse. Its brilliance was dimmed only by the raggedness of his haircut. He hated barbers and cut his own locks, and believe me, it showed. The room, furnished with an oak table and chairs, had the look of a library. We sat while Fallon paced, schooling Rodman in how to behave.
Be ever so polite. Answer all questions with a yes, sir, and no, sir. Nothing more unless you really must. As I've said from the outset, Hank, all we have to do is persuade one person, just one, that you knew nothing about the liquor hall and the stable and the booze in the books.
What about Randig?
That's my problem, not yours.
You're sure that the case is labeled New York versus James Rodd and not Hank Rodman?
It matters, Lily said.
I'm absolutely certain.
From his breast pocket, Fallon removed a gold crucifix attached to a chain of dark beads, which he handed to Rodman.
Remember what I told you?
Right, pal.
Lily and I looked at each other. We both knew that Rodman, whatever his religion, was not Roman Catholic, but we said nothing. As we entered the mahogany panel courtroom, which was divided by a center aisle, I counted 10 rows of chairs. The room was lit by 4 small chandeliers and 3 sets of windows. A bronze railing separated the public from the legal proceedings. At the front of the room, a cadaverous-looking judge sat on a raised bench. The prosecution and the defense sat at separate tables. Arrayed in 2 rows of seats along one wall, the jurymen were all dressed in their Sunday best. As I made my way to a front-row seat, I saw the familiar face of Lieutenant Sullivan and 2 of his sidekicks. Lily pointed out the infamous Charles Randig. From a side view, all I could see was his scraggly mustache and thinning hair. Although replaced by another juror, he was seated beside the DA, prepared to cry, "Bribe!" In his opening statement, the district attorney, wearing a lapel pin with the American flag, made Rodman's house sound like a Babylon of booze. Detailing the extensive cellars under the stable and the network of tunnels running down to the boathouse, he swore that it would take all of Manhattan a month to drink the store dry. Neither the bar on the lawn nor the hollowed-out books escaped his attention. He accused Rodman of flaunting his felonies and of defiling books in the service of drink. Like a steamroller, he started slowly, but once he got rolling, he was unstoppable. He touched upon maidens and mothers, virtue and vice, country and communists, religion and rum, and concluded with a question for the jury. I ask you, can you imagine any decent man lending himself to such depravity, knowing that drink is the demon's delight, and that archaeological records suggest that when Eve tempted Adam, it was because she was drunk? I knew that Westchester County had a reputation for being fogyish, so I worried up a sweat that Fallon would lose, causing no end of trouble for Rodman. As Fallon approached the bench, the judge, a rabid prohibitionist, tartly asked, "Is it possible that the court smells liquor on counsel?"
"If your honor's sense of justice is as keen as your sense of smell," replied Fallon, "then my client need have no fear in this court." With that statement, I knew Rodman had the best counsel money could buy.
Repeating the phrases, "flaunting his felonies" and "drink is the demon's delight," Fallon ironically observed that the DA was alliteratively condemning his client without an assonance or ounce of proof.
100 proof, cracked the judge.
I sweated. So much for impartiality. But Fallon didn't seem fazed in the least. He chuckled and saluted the bench, saying, "Fallon," speaking of himself in the third person, as he often did in his trials,
"is again encouraged by your honor, for your intermingling jest with earnest shows that you're a man of just proportions."
He immediately relinquished the floor, not wanting, I suppose, to tip his hand in his opening comments. The district attorney called for Lieutenant Patrick Sullivan to take the stand. a single chair positioned next to the judge's bench. Sully recounted the raid on Rodman's estate and the discovery of liquor in the stable and in the hollowed-out books. Fallon's cross-examination began with an exclamation directed to no one in particular. "Fallon finds this testimony fit for a fantasy. It's all sheer conjecture." Sharply turning to Sully, he asked, "Are you a police officer?"
22nd Precinct.
"A precinct well known for its honesty," said Fallon in a tone of voice that could easily have been understood as either a question or a statement of fact.
"I certainly hope so," said Sully.
"Hope? You don't know?"
"I know," said Sully angrily.
"You arrived at Mr. Rodd's estate with an army of men."
"Policemen, not servicemen."
"Did you know that Mr. Rodd is a New York taxpayer? He contributes to your salary. He is also a United States citizen, protected by the laws of this country against invasion of privacy."
"We had a search warrant."
"And he is a veteran of the Great War. Are you?"
"No."
The DA objected to the question, and the judge concurred, telling the jury that whether Sully served in the Great War or not was immaterial.
"In your testimony, Lieutenant Sullivan, you said that two speedboats carrying an illicit cargo docked at my client's estate."
"Yes."
"Ergo, Mr. Rodd is guilty."
"It's not just the speedboats or the docking. It's the stuff he had stashed in the cellar of the stable and the garage."
"I suppose, Lieutenant Sullivan, that if a bird were to land on the lawn of my client, by dint of the same argument, you would say that the bird not only belonged to Mr. Rodd, but had been summoned by him."
The jurors laughed. Fallon scratched his head, walked to a nearby window, looked out, and slowly returned to face Sully. In fact, all during Fallon's cross-examination, he kept pacing between the window and the witness.
"How did you know that the liquor would be landed at Mr. Rodd's estate?"
"We had a tip from an informant."
"Namely?"
"I can't say, but he was wrong."
"Not about the landing, just about the buyer."
"We also found a diamond in Mr. Rodd's house."
With elaborate sarcasm, Fallon replied,
"Oh, I see. The presence of a bauble in a house is indisputable evidence that the owner of the house is a bootlegger. Now that's good thinking, Lieutenant Sullivan."
"A hot diamond."
"Was Mr. Rodd alone in the house?"
"There was a big bash going on."
"Anyone then could have planted the jewel in the house, even, for example, your informant."
"Not likely. He wasn't there."
"Was Mr. Rodd there, on the dock? Did he, as far as you know, greet the rum runners?"
"No, but the speedboats are registered to him."
"Right now, Lieutenant Sullivan, your police car, the one checked out to you, is not where you parked it. The man who just drove it away, I trust, works for you. Is that so?"
Sully leapt out of the witness box, sputtering, "My squad car! Someone else driving it?"
He ran to the window and saw that his car was no longer in the space where he'd left it.
"Call the White Plains Police!"
The courtroom was in an uproar. The judge hammered his gavel and called for everyone to be seated. Sully returned to the stand.
"Continue," ordered the judge.
"Might I conclude from your behavior, Lieutenant Sullivan, that the driver of a vehicle, whether a speedboat or auto, may be piloting it without the permission of the owner?"
A confused Lieutenant Sullivan kept looking toward the window and mixing up his answers. "My car. Of course it's possible Mr. Rodd didn't agree, but I didn't either. I mean, who took my car? His speedboats have locks, so does my car. But I didn't give permission. He did.
How do we know?"
The district attorney requested a recess while the local police looked for Lieutenant Sullivan's car. In the hall, Rodman asked Bill how he knew the car would be missing.
I arranged with two friends to be on hand to release the brake and push the car round the corner.